a group show from local outdoor painters, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 5:30. United Way of Bemidji is collecting coats and other winter gear now until October 7th at Dress Club Cleaners and both Lukens Village Foods locations. Items may be new or gently used. Distribution will take place Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church in Bemidji. After Dark is KAXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host, Diane Ott, will be playing good old-fashioned rock and roll. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. The Iron Range Pasty Festival is Saturday, October 4th at the Mountain Iron Community Center from 4 to 7. Enjoy pasties made from all local ingredients, plus live music and local farmers market vendors. The Range Area Walk to End Alzheimer's is Sunday, October 5th at Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. Registration begins at noon with the opening ceremony at 1 p.m. and the walk to follow.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he now believes that Ukraine can retake all of its territory with the help of Europe. He called Russia a paper tiger. Trump met with Ukraine's president on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Trump says he thinks Russia's economy is in big trouble and Ukraine could win back its territory, in his words, in its original form. He made the comments in a social media post after meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky told the UN Security Council that he and Trump talked about a few good ideas.
And we expect America's actions to push Russia toward peace. Moscow fears America and always pays attention to it.
Zelensky blasted Russian President Vladimir Putin for not coming to the United Nations and accused the Russian leader of prolonging the largest war in Europe since World War II. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the United Nations.
The Secret Service says it thwarted a hidden operation that could have devastated cell towers throughout the New York City area. This involved more than 100,000 SIM cards. These are usually tucked into mobile devices like cell phones, but these were placed in multiple sites around the city. Cybersecurity expert Jordan Ray Kelly explains these are SIM farms.
It essentially operates like hundreds of thousands of cell phones in one place doing things at massive scale.
That means the operation could have cut off communication to millions of people. It's not clear who did this or whether it was intended to spy on the UN General Assembly. House Democrats are planning to hold two meetings in coming days. They'll discuss the looming federal government shutdown. That will happen a week from today unless Congress passes a spending bill. Republicans don't have enough votes to pass legislation on their own. Democrats say they won't sign on unless the GOP rescinds some of the huge cuts to federal health care programs. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says many companies in the United States are cutting back on hiring. That's because of the economy's uncertain outlook. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Hiring slowed to a crawl over the summer, and the Fed hopes to prevent a sharper slowdown by cutting interest rates. The central bank still keeping a watchful eye on inflation, though. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell told an audience in Rhode Island that President Trump's tariffs have already resulted in some price hikes, and more are expected.
Uncertainty around the path of inflation remains high. We will carefully assess and manage the risk of higher and more persistent inflation. We'll make sure that this one-time increase in prices does not become an ongoing inflation problem.
On average, members of the Fed's rate-setting committee expect to cut interest rates by an additional half percentage point by the end of this year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, Dow futures are higher this hour. This is NPR. Late-night talk show host Jimmy Kimmel has returned to the air. ABC suspended him for less than a week. That came after Trump administration officials got angry over his comments over the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Kimmel noted last night that he never intended to make light of the killing, but he then began a spirited defense of free speech principles. He also thanked Republicans who'd supported him. Video platform YouTube says it will reinstate some accounts it once banned. This was for spreading falsehoods about COVID-19 and elections. NPR's Bobby Allen reports it's the latest tech platform to loosen rules on misinformation since President Trump returned to office.
A letter from a Google lawyer to the House Judiciary Committee lays out the change. Those who were kicked off YouTube will soon have a way to come back. Google says it has retired a number of rules that had cracked down on YouTube channels that pushed COVID and election misinformation. Among the accounts that have been banned under those rules, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who now runs Health and Human Services, and Dan Bongino, who is now the FBI's deputy director. Many social media companies are dismantling content rules that the Trump administration does not like. The Google lawyer wrote to the Judiciary Committee that YouTube values conservative voices on its platform. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Typhoon Rigasa has made landfall in southern China. Officials have evacuated nearly 2 million people to safer areas. Top sustained winds from the storm are about 120 miles per hour. The storm killed at least 17 people in Taiwan. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid. Terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're getting close to a deadline for a possible government shutdown. And we've asked in Democratic strategist Maria Cardona. She'll talk in a moment about her party's approach.
But first, President Trump canceled a meeting with Democratic leaders to discuss a possible government funding deal. Negotiations seem to be stuck. The top House Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries, insists any funding bill must address health care.
Our position is not complicated. Cancel the cuts, lower the costs, save health care.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us once again. Deirdre, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so they should have been passing a one-year appropriations. They're not doing that. They're talking about a short-term extension, and Democrats want to add this thing on health care. And why did the president pull out of the meeting?
Well, he posted a lengthy message on social media, as he does, saying the demands from Democrats about attaching those health care provisions were, quote, unserious, and he said no meeting could possibly be productive. Hill Republicans propose what Democrats have voted for in the past, a straight extension of current funding levels through November 21st to get to this broader spending deal. That narrowly passed in the House last week, but it didn't get the 60 votes it needs in the Senate.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the reminder. Republicans have the majority, but in the Senate, you need more than a majority. So what are the demands that Democrats are making?
Well, they put out an alternative bill that also failed to advance last week. They want to extend tax credits that are part of the Affordable Care Act. Those help middle and working class Americans buy health care plans, and they expire on December 31st. Democrats also want to roll back the Medicaid changes that were part of the president's tax bill that he signed in July. The president says those are all non-starters.
Okay. Is there any way to avoid a shutdown then?
It seems unlikely. You know, Congress can work sometimes at the very last minute, facing a deadline to get something done, but there are no talks at this point. Republicans insist Democrats just have to back the 7-week funding bill without other policy demands on it. Congress is on recess this week, but next Monday when they get back in the Senate, the majority leader John Thune says he's going to bring up that stopgap bill again for a vote. They need 7 Democrats to get to 60 votes. So far, they only have 1. There are some Republicans who agree with Democrats that Congress needs to do some kind of extension of health care subsidies. But since those don't expire until December, they say that debate shouldn't be linked to this funding bill. That issue could be some kind of off-ramp to this stalemate.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for telling us there might be something, even though we don't exactly know. But let's talk this through. The dynamic in recent years, many recent years, is that Republicans seem eager to shut the government down or partial shutdown. Sometimes they actually go through with it and they do it. They lead the way. Sometimes they even say they like it. They've even done it when they had full control of government. But this time it is the Democrats who are making an extra demand and saying they might be willing to shut it all down. What changed?
I mean, the politics are really the driving factor right now for Democrats. Back in March, the top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, infuriated the base when he helped Republicans avoid a shutdown. Now he's arguing that Democrats are fighting to protect health care. The base really does want this fight, and denying Republicans the vote they need to advance a bill in the Senate is really the only power they have in the minority. So I anticipate we're going to just see this continued messaging war. Republicans are branding this a Schumer shutdown. If a shutdown happens, both sides are pretty hard line in their different positions, so it's going to be difficult to see how we could get out of it.
And Piers Deirdre Walsh, thanks for your insights as always.
Thanks, Steve.
We wanted to get a sense of how all this looks from a Democrat's perspective, so we've called Maria Cardona for this. She's had key positions in Democratic presidential campaigns and administrations. Maria Cardona, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, my friend. Great to be here.
So as we've said, look, the president backed out of this planned meeting with Democratic leadership. Do you see any path to avoid a shutdown?
There should be a path to avoid the shutdown, and that path is to come to the table to negotiate. It is astounding that when we are facing a government shutdown in a situation where obviously Republicans need Democratic votes, they have yet to reach out to Democrats to sit down to the table to negotiate. In fact, Trump has said that he doesn't need Democrats. Democrats understand that this is about the American people. This is about restoring healthcare cuts. This is about fixing a healthcare crisis that Republicans created when they passed the big, horrible bill that stripped 17 million Americans of their healthcare and will also strip them of their healthcare subsidies, skyrocketing the cost for Americans once they understand that, and they will have to pay so much more for health care. So this is about the American people.
Do you think that that is a message that people are actually getting? I mean, both sides are already firing off messages about who would be to blame if the government were to shut down. Do you think that this message is clear enough that people would actually believe that it's Republicans' fault?
I do, for a couple of reasons. First of all, Americans understand that Republicans control everything. They control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House. They have heard Trump say that they don't need Democrats. They have seen that House Speaker Mike Johnson has sent his caucus home saying, you guys aren't coming back, only until there is a government shutdown. So this is something they're anticipating. They have all the power. And so if there is a government shutdown, they will own that government shutdown because they did absolutely nothing to try to fix the healthcare crisis that is now going to face Americans. And Americans understand that. They know that this big, horrible bill, which is one of the most unpopular bills ever that we have had, they know that it takes away important healthcare coverage for Americans, and they see that there's only one party that's fighting to get those protections back.
Okay, and seems like there are multiple motivations here. One of them is for Democrats to show strength, as you've just pointed out, as others have pointed out, that people on the base want to see this fight. But the other motivation is a substantive one, which is Democrats say they want to deal with Republicans over health care subsidies, as you've just pointed out. We just heard from Deirdre Walz, as we have heard from others, that shutdowns usually do not result in one side getting the concessions that they want. Matthew Glassman, who's a political scientist at Georgetown, was quoted in the New York Times saying there have been a handful of shutdowns longer than a day in the modern era, and none of them did the party trying to leverage the shutdown win the concessions they were seeking. And in each case, they also lost the public opinion battle. What convinces you that this would be different?
Two things. First of all, there have already been polls that show that the majority of Americans would blame Republicans for a shutdown because they understand that they own everything. They control everything. The power is in their hands. The second thing is, we've never been in a situation where we're going into a shutdown where millions of Americans are about to lose their health care and their health care is going to skyrocket. So they understand which party is actually the one that is focused on helping Americans. Which party is focused on trying to get that healthcare crisis back into control, which Republicans are the ones who caused with the passage of this big, horrible bill. This situation has never been seen before. And so when you have that situation and Republicans control everything, they have refused to negotiate with Democrats, then Americans understand that. It's very simple. If you want a deal that requires both parties to sit down at the table and you have one party that refuses to come to the table to negotiate, if those negotiations then go haywire and the government shuts down, whose fault is it? It's Democrats that are ones that are asking for this meeting, demanding this meeting, because they know that this has to work out for America.
We have 30 seconds. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries says he plans to hold a caucus meeting Monday evening with all House Democrats when Republicans are not even scheduled to be in town. What should that meeting accomplish?
Well, that meeting needs to accomplish that for Democrats to continue to communicate this message that Democrats are trying. They're trying to negotiate. They are here in town while Republicans are AWOL. They have gone. So who's the one who's willing to negotiate and make this work? It's the Democrats, not the Republicans.
That is Democratic strategist Maria Cardona. Maria Cardona, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Trump's intervention in the politics of another country has brought relations with Brazil to a low. The president imposed tariffs and sanctions in retaliation for the prosecution of his ally, former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. A brief encounter at the UN General Assembly brought an unexpected break from this. Julia Carneiro reports.
For decades, it's been tradition for Brazil to deliver the opening speech at the General Assembly. This year, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's appearance drew particular attention, coming just before President Trump. And amid escalating tensions between the two countries, Lula didn't hold back. There is no justification for unilateral and arbitrary measures against our institutions and our economy, Lula said, alluding to the 50% U.S. tariffs on Brazilian goods imposed last month. The tariffs came on top of U.S. sanctions tied to the prosecution of far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. On Monday, those measures were extended to Viviane Moraes, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, the judge who led the case against Bolsonaro and was himself sanctioned by the U.S. Bolsonaro, a Trump ally, was recently sentenced to 27 years in prison for trying to overthrow the government after his defeat to Lula in 2022.
Agressão contra a independência do poder judiciário é inaceitável.
Attacks against the independence of Brazil's judiciary power were unacceptable, Lula said at the UN, and Brazil's sovereignty was non-negotiable. But as Lula left the stage, Trump prepared to enter, and the two men met in person for the first time backstage.
I saw him, he saw me, and we embraced.
In a brief aside during his address, President Trump described the encounter and said the two had agreed to meet next week.
We had, at least for about 39 seconds, we had excellent chemistry. It's a good sign.
Back on script, Trump said Brazil was doing poorly and would continue to do poorly unless they were working with the U.S. Outside the U.N., Brazilian Chancellor Mauro Vieira told CNN Brazil was ready to discuss the tariffs, but its sovereignty and the independence of the three branches of government were off the table. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And in just a bit, I'll be joined by Heather Johnson, and we'll be here until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Headwaters. The McCroskey Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for their new exhibit, Unearthed, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed media show developed from foraged objects. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m., whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research. All are welcome. Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji welcomes textile artist Kristen Anderson, Friday, October 3rd from 5 to 7. Anderson's exhibit is Refugia, the Seasonal Pond Project, with tapestries accompanied by words from two local poets. Anderson will give a brief presentation at 5:30. Itasca County Public Health offers a flu vaccine clinic Thursday, October 2nd from 4 to 6 at the Itasca Resource Center in Grand Rapids for those with and without insurance. No appointments are necessary. Learn about chronic wasting disease with the Minnesota Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Thursday, October 2nd from 5 to 8 at Cuyuna Brewing Company in Crosby. Find out how to prepare your deer for testing and share hunting stories and wild game recipes with other hunters. Now back to Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. France, the UK, and other U.S. allies recognized a Palestinian state this week, and President Trump didn't like it. He denounced the decisions in his address to the United Nations General Assembly.
We can't forget October 7th, can we? Now, as if to encourage continued conflict, some of this body is seeking to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave the opposite message, that this may revive the two-state solution.
Statehood for the Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
To dig deeper, I reached Anwar Gargash, who is in New York for the Assembly. He's the diplomatic advisor to the President of the United Arab Emirates, a key U.S. ally in the Gulf. And I started with the Abraham Accords, which were brokered by Trump in his first term to establish diplomatic ties between Israel and several Arab nations, including the UAE. I asked if the Accords could collapse, given the daily horrors in Gaza and a breakdown in ceasefire talks.
I have to say that the Abraham Accord is under strain. Under strain because of the war in Gaza, under strain also because of threats of annexation, etc. But it remains really one of the success stories in the region, one of the success stories of the Trump administration. And I am sure also, you know, once we do actually arrive at a ceasefire in Gaza, which we've all been, you know, working on, that this will actually take some of the strain away.
In your view, is the U.S. at all willing to use its economic and military leverage to pressure the Israeli government?
Well, I think everybody agrees that Washington's role is critical. Mm-hmm. As we work with the Americans, I think there is more and more realization that we should actually arrive at a ceasefire.
But I guess it's been almost 2 years. Next month, it will be 2 years.
Yes, and very frustrating. And very bloody.
And so I guess what I'm asking is, what gives you any hope that it will be any different? It feels further than ever.
Well, I think we have to work with a can-do attitude. But we also don't want to go to the sort of situation that existed before the war.
As in?
Meaning basically a containment of the aspirations of the Palestinians for a state. We cannot continue with old containment policies we all have to work not only at a ceasefire, but also using these monumental events in the region to create new opportunity. And that, I think, is what we are trying to do with friends and others, and of course, Washington.
Right, and we saw the recognition of a Palestinian state from France and others this week. But the reality is on the ground right now, while we're speaking, Hamas has put out a poster of all the remaining hostages in Gaza, basically saying, say goodbye to them so that their lives are in immediate and serious danger. Starvation, famine in Gaza, dozens of Palestinians being killed each day, each week. What can the UAE do to put pressure on Israel? I mean, in the past, the UAE has threatened to downgrade relations.
We've been doing many things on that. For example, about 42-43% of all the humanitarian support that's gone to Gaza has originated from the UAE. Mm-hmm. But again, on recognition, I think the recognition that we are seeing today of the Palestinian state is extremely important. I mean, it keeps alive the two-state solution as the only viable solution today. It undermines any legitimacy of the continuation of the occupation. And I think it turns around the logic, Leila, because in the beginning, the logic was negotiations leading to recognition. Right now, I think we're saying recognition, and from recognition, we will go through negotiations. These are realities. I disagree with people who say that recognition does not change anything.
Is there a red line for the UAE? You talked about the strain on the Abraham Accords, but also how important it is to keep them alive. But is there a red line for the UAE where you will reconsider this deal?
Well, we've already stated that annexation is a no-go area for us.
Israel is currently threatening that as a result of the recognition.
Israel is currently threatening that. You know, the Abrahamic Accords was based basically on a first threat of annexation at that time. And I think the Abrahamic Accords basically thwarted that annexation.
The worst humanitarian crisis on the planet right now, as we speak about human suffering, is in Sudan. And so I do feel that I have to ask you why the UAE is supporting the rapid support forces in Sudan when the U.S., the U.N. and others say they're committing a genocide, a second genocide in Darfur.
On Sudan, I think the UAE position is very clear, an immediate ceasefire to the war in Sudan, unhindered humanitarian support in Sudan. And we believe Sudan's future is not in military rule. Mm-hmm. Sudan's future is in a civilian approach. And I think for these reasons, we've been the favorite sort of bashing target for many of these, you know, Sudanese, let's say, pseudo-military and pseudo-Islamist who are trying to sort of explain their own continuation of a war that is not winnable and the cost of it is too high.
I know you called it UAE bashing, but there is a growing body of evidence that documents this. An April UN expert report found that the UAE is secretly providing weapons to armed militias in Sudan and neighboring Chad. An Amnesty International report in May found the same thing, that the RSF is using advanced Chinese weaponry that's coming through the UAE and that they're flouting the UN arms embargo. So you're saying none of this is true?
Leila, there are also other reports. I mean, number one, you know, the whole claim of the Sudanese military and the International Court of Justice just fell flat on its face. The other thing, the UN independent report of experts on Sudan did not come to the same conclusions. So definitely in a situation like this, where you are actually seeing weapons from Iran and other countries also coming to support Sudanese military, you'll get a lot of these conflicting reports.
And two conflicts that are both a situation where people are starving to death.
Yes.
Anwar Gargash is a former foreign minister and currently serving as a diplomatic advisor to the president of the UAE. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Leila.
This is NPR News.
Singer and fiddle player Amanda Shires had long collaborated with her husband, fellow Nashville star Jason Isbell. Her new album processes their divorce in a series of raw, honest songs.
After the aftermath, you know, you can find freedom, and then now I realize I don't belong to anybody but myself.
Amanda Shires on her new album, Nobody's Girl, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show, and as promised, I am joined here today by Heather Johnson.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's Wednesday already. Can you believe it?
Yes, and the days are definitely getting shorter.
Yeah, and it's all foggy out there this morning, so it's kind of like, oh, it's spooky season.
Yes. What's your favorite part of the spooky season?
The movies.
The movies?
And the sweaters.
What about the skeletons and yards?
That is also a big thing. I especially love the giant one that we have here in Bemidji. That's a good one.
Where's that one?
Oh, it's kind of on the main drag.
What if they made like the Palm Bay Park? You know how like they go all out for Christmas? What if they went all out for Halloween? Yeah, it's super spooky.
I think that would be amazing.
I think it'd be
like
so cool.
Like if there's a Halloween walkthrough kind of thing.
What if there was a bunch of skeletons?
How do we make
ones?
This happen?
I don't know. If anyone has suggestions, text us at 218-326-1234.
Skeleton Paul and Babe?
Yeah.
Can you do that?
That'd be so cool. And we are here until 9 o'clock today, and then we're going to hand things over for Headwaters. And then after that, it's going to be World Cafe. And then on the river, who is our volunteer host today?
I think. Don't we have a...
It is a Gina the Knife.
Yeah, Gina.
So coming straight from, it's going to be a Bemidji broadcast day because Sarah is hosting On the River tonight from 7 to 10 p.m.
Hey, we are spoiled for choices with our volunteers. We're just so lucky.
Absolutely. So, Heather, when the days are getting shorter, what's, is your routine changing? Do you find yourself going to bed earlier?
I wish I could say yes, but no, it does change a little bit, I guess. Yeah, because you kind of get tired out a little bit earlier, just with the light going down and everything. So yeah, probably. I mean, I would say that things don't really slow down because it's school time.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There's always stuff going on, but it's also kind of nice. And I like it when it gets a little cooler.
Yeah, I do like, but today it's going to be a warm one again.
Yeah.
We've got areas of fog until 10 a.m. this morning. Otherwise, it should be mostly sunny with highs 74 to 76. Not quite the 80s, but we're getting close. Calm winds. Tonight, mostly clear. Lows 54 to 56. Calm wind. And then tomorrow, sunny. Highs in the mid to upper 70s. Overnight lows in the high 40s. Do you notice, does it seem like the leaves are changing quicker this year?
I thought it was kind of a slower pace. What do you think?
I feel like I'm surprised how many colors have already changed.
Yeah, it's really getting pretty. And then just about the time it all explodes, then we get like some crazy wind or rain and it knocks them all off.
So that ties into our question week. Where are your favorite places to go to look at fall colors? You can text us at 218-326-1234. Heather, do you have a favorite spot? Or is it a secret?
Well, Maplewood State Park is, you can't really beat it. It's beautiful out toward Pelican Rapids. It's gorgeous. Very hilly out there. And yeah, it's just, that's fall for me. How about you?
I like to go to Itasca State Park.
Yeah.
That's my favorite spot, going up to the fire tower and then looking at all the leaves.
Fire tower is awesome. That's a good spot.
Yeah, so that's my go-to. What's your go-to spot for fall colors? Text us at 218-326-1234. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com.
And now is a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there's 988 with support that meets you where you are, confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org.
Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, was recently renewed. It provides compensation for uranium miners and people exposed to Cold War-era nuclear testing in what could be a final round of applications. Allegations of predatory representation and solicitation are on the rise, targeting tribal communities, as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
President Trump signed the RECA renewal on the 4th of July as part of his sweeping One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
By the 5th, I started getting these calls.
Immediately, Loretta Anderson noticed a problem. She's a tribal member from the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico and says some attorneys and companies see RECA as an opportunity to cash in.
They're not only going door to door, but they're also having meetings almost every week.
This year marks 8 decades since the U.S. detonated its first atomic bomb at the Trinity test site in the New Mexico desert. Yet until now, no one in the land of enchantment could have ever filed a downwinder claim.
They mined them, made billions of dollars off the uranium, and when it was all said and done, they just left our people sick, suffering, and dying.
More than $2.6 billion has been already paid out for 42,000 claims since 1990. Members from 24 tribes account for at least 5,300 of those claims, most of which are linked to the Navajo Nation. Depending on their occupation or condition, claimants are eligible for up to $100,000. And that leads Anderson to worry about those very victims also falling prey to opportunistic third parties.
They're all coming out of the woodwork. Again, this angers me.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatarazio.
Renewable energy provides a sizable share of power in some rural Alaska communities, but these are tough times to seek federal funding for wind and solar. Denali Commission Programs Director Jocelyn Fenton testified recently to a U.S. Senate committee about the energy needs in rural Alaska. She emphasized fossil fuels.
Life in these villages depends on a fragile but vital infrastructure system. Small diesel powerhouses, bulk fuel tank farms, and water treatment systems.
President Trump has paused or defunded renewable energy projects across the country. His 2026 budget would reduce funding for the Office of Indian Energy while disallowing any of it for wind, solar, or battery projects. The hearing in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee was entitled Unleashing Indian Energy. That's a twist on President Trump's executive orders that call for unleashing American and Alaska's energy. But for participants in the hearing, the nuanced message is that renewables should be unleashed too. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the committee, says government programs should not favor one energy source over another.
The projects that we can get online quickest and quite honestly cheapest right now are wind and solar, and we do have several of these that are in that pause category along with some battery storage.
The top Democrat on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, said his information is that the Office of Indian Energy is sitting on about $30 million, nearly half of the funds Congress appropriated for the fiscal year. The year ends in a few weeks, though some funds can be held over from one budget cycle to the next. The acting head of the office, David Conrad, said he's not discriminating against renewables with that money, just waiting for word from higher ups in the administration that he has approval to spend it. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Indenburg Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
You're listening to The Morning Show on KAXE KBXE. And welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
That's Heather Johnson. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We're here until 9 o'clock, and then we're going to hand things over to Malachi Coons for Headwaters this morning, because Kari Hedlin is gone this week because, well, I don't know why, but it is her birthday today, so...
It is. Birthday celebrations, I bet.
I would think so. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to hear from... more from Morning Edition, talking about the MLB new challenge system, and the student podcast champion. That'll be coming up in just a bit. Ooh. Are you a podcast fan, Heather?
Yes, I am. I listen to lots of podcasts, actually. Some of them only to fall asleep. Oh. But how about you?
I listen to quite... how many do I have in the regular rotation? I've got at least like 4 or 5 in the regular rotation.
4 or 5 is good.
Yeah. Not all of them. I don't listen to all of them like as soon as they come out kind of thing. Some of them are kind of always on the back burner kind of thing. But I've got at least 2 that I listen to every week for sure.
Okay. I'm going to guess. Are they music related?
One is music related.
And one is movies related. Yeah. Yes.
One comes out on Friday, one comes out on Sunday.
Oh, that's nice, too.
It's the most wonderful time of the week.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially if you're looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's like the perfect thing to do while you're just like kind of doing little chores around the house kind of thing.
Yeah, or even just decompressing. And,
yeah, that's true. Like yeah. I like just to sit down with, I have a Nintendo Switch and just play Tetris 99 where you compete against 99 other people in a Tetris game.
Oh, is that what that meant? I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah,
okay,
it's so fun.
Yeah, and sometimes I have a cup of coffee and I just stare at whatever and listen to the podcast or do chores or whatever, you know.
Well, what about your two cats? You can stare at them.
They're not mine. They're Alex's cats. They're the worst. No, they're not that bad. They're okay.
How can you say about Hugs?
He's getting better, and then he gets worse, and then he gets better, but they're pretty entertaining, I have to say. Poor Hugs. I'm slandering him every week.
I just love his name's Hugs.
He's a big guy.
So, coming up later in the show, we're going to have Area Voices, my conversation with a representative from the Kichigami Regional Library System, talking about the Art Kits program they have been doing since May this past year and will continue till November. And then they're going to change it up a little bit in the winter months, doing more of like craft type projects. But you'll hear more about that coming up around 8:40 this morning. And in about an hour, we're going to be talking about a upcoming Lions Club, Bemidji Lions Club fundraising event going on.
Yeah, we've got lots to talk about today.
Absolutely. So, we receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org.
And we receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org.
Now more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In baseball, disagreeing with an umpire's call is just about as old as the sport itself. But it didn't mean much, except maybe some good theater from time to time. Now, though, players' objections might actually bring results. Starting next season, Major League Baseball will introduce an automated challenge system for balls and strikes. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Let me explain first how this system is going to work.
0-2 on Machado.
This is this year's All-Star game where they tried it out. It's the bottom of the first inning. The Cy Young favorite, Tarek Skubal, is on the mound, mic'd up, talking to the Fox broadcast crew. Batter Manny Machado is at the plate, down on an 0-2 count. Skubal throws a fastball near the bottom of the zone.
Ball down!
Oh, challenge that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The umpire calls it a ball. Catcher Cal Raleigh disagrees and taps his helmet, the signal to trigger a review. On the screen, a computerized replay shows that, in fact, the pitch was a strike. Batter's out. Big ol' smile crosses Skubal's face.
Hey, you take him any way you can get him, boys.
MLB has tested this system out for a while in the minor leagues. Most major leaguers experienced it for the first time during spring training this year.
I thought the umpires were really locked in spring training. Hitters were really locked in during spring training. I thought it was great.
This is Rob Thompson, the manager of the Philadelphia Phillies. Each team will start every game with two challenges. If a player gets his challenge wrong, the team loses one. But if the player gets it right, the team gets to keep that challenge and can use it again.
I love it. And I loved it in spring training. And I think it keeps everybody accountable. It keeps everybody on their toes.
The only players who can call for a challenge will be the pitcher, catcher, or batter. And they have to do it right away without a sign from the dugout. In spring training this year, there were some really silly challenges. Guys just trying it, seeing what it's like, having a laugh. But come next season, when it's rolled out in games that count, that'll all have to sharpen up, says Aaron Boone, the manager of the New York Yankees.
What are the rules in a particular inning, in a particular bat, particular counts, and things like that? Making sure you are as buttoned up as you can be so you're in a position to, you know, overturn the most impactful calls of the game in a given night.
In spring training, there were about four challenges a game. That added about a minute on average to the duration. Players got the calls overturned a little more than half the time. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Today, we're announcing the grand prizes at NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. And for the first time, we have a returning champion. Last year, a student at Williams Elementary School in San Jose, California, brought us the story of her grandfather's forced migration from Uganda. Amaya Desai is now a fifth grader, and her new podcast is our middle school winner. NPR's Janet Ujong Lee reports.
After her winning podcast last year, Amaya Desai heard from a neighbor.
Would the 11-year-old journalist interview his grandmother, a survivor of the Japanese incarceration camps?
I was amazed that I've never learned about this story here, and it's happened right here in San Jose. And I was, like, so shocked.
That spark led her to 85-year-old Linda Horikawa.
I was surprised that someone in the fifth grade was interested in the relocation of the Japanese Americans during World War II. And I thought, good time to let everybody know what really happened.
I'm Amaya Desai, and you are listening to Far From Home.
The story begins in 1940, Cupertino, California.
My mom and dad had a berry ranch. We had boysenberries, blackberries, strawberries. We were very happy.
But those happy times at the family farm were soon upended.
Following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, there was a growing resentment towards Japanese Americans, many of whom were questioned about their loyalty to the United States.
In 1942, the U.S. forced nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans to leave the West Coast. Horikawa was 2 years old, her sister three.
You can take only the things you could carry. And so mom carried the suitcases, dad carried the cribs, and then off we went.
Horikawa shares details of life in the incarceration camp in Heart Mountain, Wyoming.
The guns that they had were pointed in at us. We were in barracks, and we had one room, no running water, just a stove for heating.
And it was 3 years before they were able to return to California.
Even though the Yamamoto family reclaimed their home, it wasn't easy to integrate back into their community.
There was prejudice. Like kids would say to us, your eyes go like this. It affected my parents more. I saw that the joy that they had in life was kind of gone.
In telling her story to Amaya, Horikawa opened up a black trunk full of documents that had been sitting in her closet.
You saw these, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She opened it again one breezy afternoon, sitting with me on Amaya's back porch in San Jose.
This trunk actually was the trunk that my mom and dad took to camp. And these are the relocation authority passes that we had to keep on us all the time.
Horikawa grew up in San Jose and became a kindergarten teacher in Amaya's school district. She taught there for many years and retired. Until their interview, she hadn't opened this trunk in 25 years. You've never shared these stories before until then.
No.
What compelled you?
Being a teacher, you want to further children's interests in different things. And here I found a friend. Yeah, I wouldn't have done it except for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
As she packs up her documents back in the trunk, Horikawa remembers how she felt listening to Amaya's podcast.
Oh, gosh. I get emotional knowing that someone could be that interested in what happened to another group of people.
Amaya says getting to hold on to this history means so much more than creating a winning podcast.
I am honored because I got to share her story. It also means another story that will not be lost to time. Another story that may help people to not repeat the same mistakes.
Janet Ujung Lee, NPR News, San Jose, California.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This afternoon, in All Things Considered, we have the high school winner of the Student Podcast Challenge. A Texas teen tells the story of the villages in Kerala, India, where her grandparents grew up. Listen in the NPR app or on your smart speaker or on this local public radio station. This station, which brings you Morning Edition. Unlike some other media, it's a station in your community, run by people in your community, serving your community, supported by this community, reporting independently in your interest. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show, People Power Radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with the one and only Heather Johnson.
Yes, the one and only. Good morning.
Good morning. So, what if you were to start a podcast tomorrow, you have to.
Yeah.
What would your podcast be about?
I would love to have an old-time radio podcast.
Oh.
I Well, I love listening to the programs. I absolutely love that. But then, like, providing, like, history and context, I would be all over that. It's one of my favorite things to read about as well. So.
Would you, like, promote Ovaltine?
Yes! Do you know what? There's Ovaltine in my cupboard right now.
Wow! Do you remember in the movie A Christmas Story where he gets, like, the secret Dakota message from...
Yeah.
Is it Little Orphan Annie?
Yes. Yep.
And the message is drink more Ovaltine.
He's so let down. And like, what is it? His family is pounding on the bathroom door where he's trying to, he thinks he needs to serve his country and to do something for Little Orphan Annie and the allies. And it's just drink more Ovaltine.
Yeah, that's such a great bit. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It is. You know what, though? This is controversial.
Uh-oh. You don't like A Christmas Story?
I do not like that movie.
What? What about Fragile?
That, there are so many good bits, but as a movie, it stresses me out. It just stresses me out, the whole thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I think what the reason it's so successful, because it's like on the 24 hours marathon on TBS, is that it is a movie where it's like, as a whole, it's kind of just like a bunch of scenes put together that may not really necessarily correlate all that much. So it's perfect to just like jump in at some random time in the movie and just watch for a bit.
Yeah.
And then go back to doing whatever you're doing.
Well, as a, yeah, and as a memoir sort of, you know, movie.
I guess that's life, isn't it, Heather?
I guess it is.
It's just a hodgepodge of our memories.
Well, and I think a lot of them, you know, it's not a failing of a movie to be too relatable, but it's kind of like too relatable in some ways. I don't know. It's a good, solid movie. I admit that. I just do not enjoy it.
Oh. Well, we're getting into the spooky season.
Yeah.
Have you started your list of horror movies you're going to watch in the next month?
I haven't made a list,
okay.
But I
do. You got
do...
some on mind.
So many.
So many.
I love scary movies. I love horror movies. But
what's your favorite scary movie?
Probably Dawn of the Dead, the remake, though.
Which one's that?
It's from, what, 2004?
Is it still in a mall?
Yes.
Okay.
And it is so good. It is so good.
I finally watched the original Dawn of the Dead last year.
Yep.
And it's not available like on any physical media, or like it's so out of print that it's like ridiculously expensive. But someone posted on YouTube the whole thing.
Wow, that really surprises me, because the Romero ones are like, or Romero ones
Romero,
are very...
For some reason, a bunch of his movies are just like in limbo rights issues.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. And those are good too. I like the humor mixed in with the horror for the remake. I just think they do it really well. And I'm a huge fan of Sarah Polley.
Oh, I didn't know she was in it.
Yeah, she's like one of the main characters. So she's great. I love Hocus Pocus. I know. But I really enjoy watching that one with my family every year. 28 Days Later. I love zombies. What can I say? Bride of Frankenstein. Nosferatu.
Oh.
But that one you actually have to watch. You can't just listen to. So. How about you? Do you have your spooky season list?
I have a few that are for sure I'm going to watch. I'm going to watch Train to Busan.
Yes. Have you
seen
it before? Oh my gosh. It's so good.
And I've never seen the original Paranormal Activity. You're going to watch that.
I like those movies as well.
This movie called It's Alive with a baby monster born.
Yeah,
and it eats like
one.
The surgeons or whatever that help get it.
Spoilers.
Birth, I think. And I'm going to watch the original Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney. I've never seen the whole thing before.
I haven't either. Oh, that's a great list. There's some really good stuff in there. Paranormal Activity. Okay. My husband and I have seen all of those movies.
Wow.
And we're not even like real big haunted house sort of genre people, but those are really fun. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that in our first house, my husband had set up the sound system way too well where we watched movies. We had this great projector set up and everything. And It sounded, we were listening downstairs and it legitimately sounded with the sound design like people were walking around upstairs, even though we were the only.
I don't like that at all.
It was kind of great, but then I was like, you go first. Let the monsters get you first. I'll be by the door.
So if you have some horror movies you're looking forward to watch in, well, let's call it Rocktober. That's what
it is.
Yeah,
it's Rocktober. Just about.
Yeah, just about Rocktober. Text us at 218-326-1234. What's your, like, go-to horror movie every year? One I've started as a tradition is Near Dark, the Catherine Bigelow vampire movie, where it's a bunch of, like, roaming leather jacket-wearing vampires.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, how do you feel about Lost Boys, then?
I've never seen Lost Boys.
You are kidding me.
No.
Oh, wow.
But I have to watch Near Dark because I paid $50 for the Blu-ray.
Okay.
Because it's out of print.
Okay.
And yeah. I bought it at a record store, and I was like, I want to buy this. And they're like, oh, you do know it's $50.
They were like, no, that's good.
No, they were like, you sure you want to pay $50 for a Blu-ray? And it's like, I'm sorry, ma'am, there's a lot of things wrong with me, so I need to buy this Blu-ray.
There's a lot of things. It's a me problem. This isn't like a horror movie, but what's the one where the lady is, she's very, very ill and she's in bed and she finds out that someone is, oh, it's Wrong Number.
Oh, I never heard of that.
I think this is called Wrong Number. Our corrections department will let me know, I'm sure. But it is so, so good. Yeah, she's stuck in bed and then she gets a wrong number and she finds out that something bad is happening and it's very tense. Oh my gosh, that is a very good movie.
I'll add it to the list.
Yes.
All right. Another thing that happened last week, I got to see one of my favorite bands of all time, Pulp.
Yeah.
And they are promoting their new album, More. This is the first time in the city since 1996, I think they said during the show. So it was very exciting to see them. And one of the highlights of the show was this song, which they ended the show with. This is Pulp with the song, A Sunset.
A scan. And then new options. I did not have a choice. I'd like to teach the world to sing, but I do not have a voice. So I bought myself a ticket to the happening of the year. The sky lit up with colours. The crowd let out a cheer. It's just a sunset. Someone said something that happened every day. Yes, it's a sunset. Someone said, but now they found a way to make it. I like to look at pretty things. I like to feast my eyes. Went to see the northern lights, but they were pale and weak, and not as advertised. So now I'm learning about money, and I'm learning about law. The first rule of economics, unhappy people, they spend more. It's just a sunset. Someone said something is coming to an end. Yes, it's a sunset. Someone said, and just exactly how much did you spend? Oh, I'd like to teach the world to sing, but I do not have a voice. And I'd like to buy the world sometime, sometime. But a choice, yes, I'd like to. We'll be right back.
And that was Pulp with the song A Sunset from their new album, More. Here on the Wednesday Morning Show, I'm Andrew Zingle here with Heather Johnson. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota.